I'm Shane Morris. Thanks for listening to the Breakpoint Podcast. Today we have John Stonestreet's presentation at the Alliance Defending Freedom. Citing A.W. Tozer, John argues that what we think about God is the most important thing about us. He then walks us through the last two centuries and shows how the culture's prevailing view of God led to the bloodiest century in human history. Then he discusses the five gods of our age: sex, self, state, science, and stuff. Here's John Stonestreet.
On behalf of the Colson Center, we consider the Alliance Defending Freedom to be one of the closest allies that we have, and they do such a great job of supporting us. About four years ago now, the Colson Center, which is one of the legacy organizations of the late, great Chuck Colson, became a separate organization from Prison Fellowship, which birthed us. And ADF has been just a huge part of supporting what we do, and so we're so grateful for that. And this has kind of been an annual gig, I think, now for 5 or 6 years, so it's great. If you've been here 5 or 6 years so far, sorry for all the repeat jokes, but, you know, you do what you can. I want to start this week, and I actually want to spend a lot of time this week kind of going back maybe to some basics. Some basics as we try to understand our place in the culture and our place in the world as followers of Jesus. I'm a dad, and among the people that you'll see with me this week are my family. My wife Sarah and I have 4 kids, 3 daughters and a son. Abigail, Anna, and Allie were born first. They're 13, 11, and 9, and they prayed together. They conspired together against the will of their parents that God would give them a little brother. And after 8 years, God gave them a little brother. So we have a 1-year-old boy named Hunter. And so we have a full life. It's really great. But as all parents who are followers of Jesus, what we want our kids to do is to know God and to trust God and to love God and to follow God. And that's really the desire of our hearts. And that would be hard enough if we were just trying to do that in a vacuum. Like if there were no other external forces going after their hearts and minds, we weren't living in a culture that was constantly feeding them ideas that weren't true, that would be hard enough. Because as you who are parents realize, you know, our kids, they kind of make stuff up in their own minds, right? You could tell them exactly what to think, and they think for themselves. I learned this quite early from my oldest daughter, Abigail, who's now 13. But when she was 3 years old, I was traveling somewhere, and Anna, my second daughter, was only 1 at the time, so 3 years old and 1 year old and a 1-year-old, and my wife was putting them to bed, and as Abigail tucked in her little sister and she was leaving her room, she leaned in and looked at her little sister and said, "God will be with you tonight, Anna. God will be with you," which was a really sweet moment. But then she turned around to my wife and said, "Hey, Mommy, I told Anna that God would be with her, and the other God will be with me." And I thought, oh, no. I work for Chuck Colson, and my daughter's a polytheist. Like, how did this happen? I mean, you know, and what we think about God is a fundamental aspect, obviously, of our lives. I mean, philosophers talk about the difference between, what you might call add-on beliefs and controlling beliefs. We have a lot of beliefs in our life. We have beliefs about sports. We have beliefs about, you know, vacation spots. We have beliefs about politics. And these are beliefs that are, by and large, peripheral beliefs. But there are those beliefs that what you could call controlling beliefs, that what you think about these things control what you think about everything else. And certainly God is one of those beliefs. In his masterful book, The Idea of the Holy, A.W. Tozer said that what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What comes into our mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And I think what we've seen in particular, as we look back over the last several hundred years of human history, that what comes into our minds when we think about God is not only the most true thing about us as individuals, but that it becomes the most true, it becomes the most important thing about our cultures and our societies. In other words, not just our lives as individuals, but it becomes the most important thing about our collective lives together, as families, as communities, as societies, as nations, and certainly as larger civilizations. one of the more important articles, and I've quoted this the last several years here. I just think it's really important. In fact, I think it was 4 years ago at this event, Rod Dreher was here. Of course, Rod is the author of a book called The Benedict Option, which I have kind of a love-hate relationship with, and he and I have talked about that. But he wrote an article back in 2013, and I think it really gave a wonderful framing for the kind of a transition that we've been in Western culture, especially in American culture. It was a book. It was an article called on his blog on American Conservative called "Sex After Christianity," and the key point of that, he was talking about the transitions that we've seen kind of in the late chapters of the sexual revolution. But the larger theme is what I want to point at, and that is as followers of Jesus, as people who pay attention to what's happening in culture and civilization, we tend to look at the changes that we've undergone. And by the way, have there been some dizzying changes in our culture over the last decade or what? Right? I mean, the speed at which things went from being unthinkable to unquestionable is dizzying, to say the least. And we look at those things, and what we're tempted to do is to see those things primarily as moral shifts. In other words, things that were once considered morally right are now considered morally wrong. And things that were once considered morally wrong are now considered morally right. Now, that's obviously true. There's no question that that really has taken place, that there's been a significant shift in what we think are right and wrong, how we answer the moral questions. But his point, and I think it's an accurate point, is that the moral shift that we have seen in the West is the effect, not the cause. It's the fruit, not the root. That the slide in morality that we have undergone is actually evidence of a much deeper shift that has taken place. And that is a shift that he called the cosmological shift. In other words, that the reason that we have undergone such dramatic changes as a society in what we think is right and wrong is because we have undergone fundamental shifts in what we think what we think about when we think about things like the nature of reality, what it means to be human. And I would say then, in light of A.W. Tozer's quote, what we fundamentally worship, what we fundamentally think about God. I want to point you to Romans chapter 1. Romans 1 talks about this in very clear terms, and it talks about it both on a personal level and as a collective level. Verse 18 of Romans 1, Paul writes, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." So there you have moral categories. You have that category also of truth. We're going to revisit that tomorrow. "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that he has made." Now there Paul is saying there's been this dramatic shift in what we think about when it comes to truth, when it comes to morality, and yet what is true is observable in the world around us, right? That the artist, the grand artist, a God, has left his fingerprint in his grand masterpiece of creation. And so, the verse 20 continues, "They are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore," now look at the cause and effect here, "because they lost worship, because they lost the right understanding of what should have been obvious, therefore," Paul writes, "God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their body among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creation, rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever and ever. Amen." Now, there's a saying that we like to use around the Colson Center, and it's a saying that we borrow from Richard Weaver. You know the saying, ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. I always like to add chapter 2 to that, because ideas are a whole story. It's not just ideas have consequences, but bad ideas have victims. Ideas have consequences and bad ideas have victims. But I also want to add another layer to this, and that is that ideas have consequences, bad ideas have victims, but ideas also have context. In other words, in certain historical contexts, certain ideas have more power than others do. And what I want to do is kind of highlight how this shift has happened, how this cosmological shift when it comes to what we think about God has taken place. Remember Tozer's quote, "What comes into our mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us." We are in the end of a massive several hundred year experiment to do life without God, to orient and order life without God. And it's interesting how the early predictions of how this would go have proven to be just desperately wrong. Of course, in his masterful article called The 20th Century, Is It the End or Just the Beginning? Henry Grunewald, who wrote for Time magazine, this was an article written back in 1992, traced the history of the 20th century. So he gets to the end of the 20th century and he turns around and he looks back and he's trying to give it some context. And it's interesting because what he says is, you know, the 18th century, started to elevate the glories of science, and it moved God from an active participant to an approving observer. In other words, looking at the glories that man was achieving through reason and science and clapping along about how well his creation is doing. That was the 18th century. The 19th century, he said, voted God out altogether. And of course, there was that kind of central event of the 19th century, the publication of a book that offered the last needed explanation of the world that didn't require God. Science had explained so much. All that was left was the explanation for the existence of biological diversity in all living things. And so the book that came to be known as the nail in the coffin of God was what book? Origin of Species, right? Because that was the explanation that we had. And see, there was a rumor because that was among the elites, that was among the intellectuals and the scientists, and especially the social observers, that because humans were growing so fast in leaps and bounds because of the scientific revolution and the growing technological revolution, that the phenomenal thing was is that we were now no longer in need of God. And that was the progression, really a progression from deism to atheism to the 20th century. So you have the explanation of the universe that doesn't require God, origin of species, the last nail in the coffin of God, which is at the end of the 19th century. And then people were trying to figure out, what's the 20th century going to be? And people predicted that many people were predicting a utopian future. Most social observers were looking at the 20th century, saying the 20th century, we were going to enter a stage of unfettered prosperity and economic progress. And we were going to rid the world of diseases. We were going to, you know, basically fix what's wrong with the world. It sounded like an Obama speech, really, in a lot of ways. And this prediction, sorry, should I not have said that? This prediction that we were going to fix the world, it was a prediction by a bunch of utopian observers. But in stark contrast to those predictions, there was another one. It was by an atheist. Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche, of course, is famous for that saying, God is what? Dead. He was famous for saying that, right? But Nietzsche looked at the end of the 19th century, heading into the 20th century, and the scientific progress and the elimination of God from the public imagination and the dismissal of God from the fact that we actually needed somebody to tell us what to do and to give us kind of our understanding of right and wrong. And while everyone else was predicting utopia, Nietzsche predicted something else. He predicted that the 20th century would not be a century of progress. It would be a century that was bloody. It would be a century of conflict. It would be a century of death and destruction. Now, of course, who proved to be right? The utopianist or Nietzsche? Nietzsche did. The 20th century was the bloodiest century in human history. Nietzsche wrote about it in all kinds of different ways. But one of those was in a parable called The Parable of the Madman. And I want to read it here because it's so instructive. Now, I guess I need to preface this. I remember in college once hearing Dr. Norman Geisler. You guys know Dr. Geisler? He's one of the top theologian and apologists kind of the last generation. He still teaches at Southern Evangelical Seminary, I think, in Charlotte at times. But when I was a senior in college, Dr. Geisler came to our school and spoke, and he mentioned that sometimes he read Friedrich Nietzsche for devotions. And we said, what? And he said he reads Friedrich Nietzsche for devotions because the darker the dark, then the brighter the light. Now, I'm not sure I should recommend that you should read Friedrich Nietzsche for devotions ever, so this is not an endorsement of that saying, but we're going to read Nietzsche for devotions this morning. Is that all right? All right. That's the best preface I can give here. Here it is. The parable of the madman. Nietzsche writes, "Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours? And he ran into the marketplace and cried incessantly, 'I seek God, I seek God.' As many of those who did not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. 'Has he got lost?' asked one. 'Did he lose his way like a child?' asked another. 'Is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage? Has he immigrated?' Thus they yelled and they laughed." Now, I hope you can see, bless you. I hope you can see kind of what they're doing, what Nietzsche is doing here. You light a lantern in the bright morning hours. This is a reference to the Enlightenment, right? Which gave birth to this modern period where human reason and science was going to take us to new levels of human achievement. And we no longer needed God. And here the madman, even though it's bright, lights a lantern. Because he thinks they're still in the dark. And he asked about God, and all of them make fun of him because no one believes in God anymore. This is the time when Nietzsche's writing. "Thus they yelled and they laughed. So the madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. 'Where is God?' he cried. 'I will tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how do we do this? How can we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained the earth from its sun? Where is it moving now? Where are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually backward, sideward, forward in all directions? Is there still an up and a down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is the night not continually closing in on us? Do we not need to light lanterns now in the morning? Do we hear nothing as yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we smell nothing as yet of the divine decomposition? God's too decomposed. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off of us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? Listen to this. What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we now have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? There has never been a greater deed, and whoever is born after us for the sake of this deed, he will belong to a higher history than all the history hitherto." Do you see what he's saying here? See, he's realizing something that the utopianists did not. The utopianists believed that they could just get rid of God, and once God got off their back, they could move forward into a time of progress and prosperity. They could make the world as they wanted it. We could actually either, and primarily the two ways that this was done, either through economics or through eugenics, we could either breed a perfect human race, or we could economically determine a human race, and those two kind of streamheads gave birth to the great evil of the 20th century. That the idea, though, from the utopianists was with God off our back, we could move forward. What Nietzsche realized that the utopianists didn't is that what you believe about God is not just what you believe about God, but what we believe about God is what we believe about everything else. There's this wonderful line in here where Nietzsche says, "Have we not unchained the earth from its sun?" Right? That was one of the great discoveries of the modern era, one of the great discoveries of the fathers of modern science, that the sun didn't revolve around the earth, but the earth revolved around the sun. And if the sun disappears, the earth now, what does it mean? What does it mean to be up and down? How are we going to be warm? How are we going to have light? You see, this is what Nietzsche was realizing, is that God had been the sun of the world. It had been the center of it. And you don't get rid of the sun without changing everything on the earth. And you don't get rid of God without just not getting rid of God. You get rid of our framework for how we understand literally every other part of our lives. He understood that Western civilization had been ordered around the idea of God, that what we thought about God had ordered our sense of who we are as humans. It ordered our sense of family, our sense of what it means to educate, how we understand laws and government and all kinds of other things. And you get rid of God and we've got to reconstruct the world. Does any of this sound familiar? That was the project of the 20th century. And this is where Nietzsche was right and the utopianists were wrong. He continues, "Here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners. They too were silent, and they stared at him in astonishment. And so he threw his lantern on the ground and it broke in pieces and it went out. I've come too early, he said. My time is not yet. This tremendous event is still on its way. It's still wandering. It's not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars require time. And deeds, like the murder of God, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant from them than the most distant stars. And here's the punchline. And yet they have done it themselves. It's been related further that on the same day, the madman forced his way into several churches and there struck up his requiem antinom Deo, led out and called to account. He is said to have always replied nothing but this: what are all these churches now if they are not the tombs and the sepulchers of God? This is Nietzsche writing at the end of the 20th century, and I'm not sure there is a more accurate prediction of where the 20th century was going to go. And so we became basically a society, the 20th century, a society, and basically a global world in which we were trying to build and reconstruct the world without God. This was the project of secularism. And secularism really did two things to the idea of God. First of all, it radically privatized God. So in other words, it's okay for you to still believe in God. It's still okay for you to find meaning and purpose, maybe personal warmth and personal light from your personal son, but it's not something that's true about the world. So it was a project of what you could call radical privatization. And when you radically privatize God, what happens is then you radically privatize things like morality, anything that's not scientifically testable or physical. You radically privatize the idea of God. So that was the first project of secularism. Secondly, it was to push, so the belief in God became more and more and more internal, then the role of God and religious things like morality in the public square went more and more to the outside. So in other words, it's okay for you to have personal private belief in God. But when you start talking about how we order our public lives, the belief in God has to be peripheral, not central. That was the real kind of the double focus project of secularism. But here's the third thing, actually, that secularism did. Not only radically privatizing God and pushing religious categories to the margins of the public square and our public institutions and our public projects, but the third thing is, and we need to understand that. Let me put it this way. Let me give you this preface on this point. We may think that God exists, but God doesn't exist because we think he does. He exists whether we think he does or not. In other words, we can actually try this project of secularism. We can try to push God to the margins and God to the internal of people's lives, but that's not where God exists. What we know to be true is that God actually is the creator of heavens and earth. And that should be obvious, Paul writes in Romans 1. And so when we are actually trying to push God to the internal, the internal kind of interior life that we had and push him to the exterior of society, even as we're trying to do that, it doesn't move God one bit, right? You could push God all you want, but God is where God is. And we live in a world in which humans, as much as they want to push God out of the picture, what happens is God stays the same, and instead other gods are elevated in their place. This is what Paul says, doesn't he, when he says this, that God gives them up to the lust of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. I think it's a little bit odd to put Paul and Friedrich Nietzsche kind of in the same, in the same descriptive work of where we're at in the world, but I really think that Paul gives you the big picture and Nietzsche gives you the story of the 20th and 21st century. But because we still live in God's world, as much as we want to think we don't live in God's world, this is one of the things that John Calvin said about God's world, is that human beings are incurably religious. We may try to be irreligious. We may try to be secular. We may try to push God into the margins of society, into the interior recesses of our own heart. But the world we still live in still belongs to him. And so that means what happens is we replace gods. That's what Paul says. We get rid of God. We put other gods in their place. I think that there are five gods of secularism, five gods of our age. What we have seen as Nietzsche's predictions have carried out, as Paul's understanding of reality has carried out and proven to be true, I think we see five replacement gods of our age. And I want to walk through those gods and kind of the difference that they make. The first god of our age is sex. Oh, by the way, I used to be Baptist, so all of these gods are going to start with the same letter, okay? Yeah, alliteration. That's right. Remember a pastor once saying, we're going to get to heaven and God is going to be like, stop alliterating. I'm tired of it. Anyway, here's the first one. Sex. Sex is one of the gods of our age. In fact, it's interesting. We kind of think about that, and there's obvious ways that we see sex kind of moving into the place of God. If you look at pop culture, there's actually been two songs in the last 10 years that have talked about that. One was from an Irish atheist named Hozier, who basically sang a song called Take Me to Church. Does anybody remember the song from about five? You remember this? I remember once speaking to a group of parents, and the parents came up to me, and they were like, have you heard this song? Isn't it great that they're talking about going to church on the radio? I'm like, that's not First Baptist. That's a different church. Hozier essentially was basically, if you look at that song, there's a replacement God, which is a girl. There's a replacement salvation, which is orgasm. There's a replacement church, which is the bedroom. And there's a replacement revelation, which is the experience that you have when you have sex with this girl. That basically is, you know, you kind of see this kind of alternative worship language in this song. There's a brand new song by Ariana Grande, God is a Woman. And basically, she's making the case that if you sleep with her, you'll realize that she's God. And the imagery, I just looked through a description of the imagery of the music video, and it's kind of a recapturing and reframing of a Gaian earth worship, woman worship, kind of feminist worship sort of motif. It's really incredible. We can look at that and say, well, so those are the obvious ways that we see sex, being worshipped in our society. That's fine. But honestly, what you need to understand is that those who gave us the sexual revolution actually saw sex as a replacement to traditional Christian worship. You see, what Sigmund Freud, for example, believed was that any moral categories on sexuality were a denial of who we were. And so you can understand, he was famous for kind of thinking that so much of who we are could be explained by sexual repression. The problem for Freud was not when you expressed yourself sexually, but when you repressed yourself sexually, kind of in any sort of way. But the classic one was Margaret Sanger. Sanger, of course, made the sexual revolution possible by giving us and promoting birth control. Until you could separate sex from babies, you can't have the sexual revolution. But she tangibly promoted the way to separate sex from babies through birth control, and ultimately, of course, founding the organization that has ultimately severed that connection. And in her book, The Fight for Birth Control, she actually says, sex will give us the only path to earthly paradise and the only replacement for religion. She actually believes sex was a replacement for that. And you say, well, where is sex a replacement how is sex something to be worshipped? It's fundamentally this, that our fundamental, let me give you a quote. Augustine in his Confession says, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in what? Because you have formed us for what? Yourself, O God, Augustine said, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you. From the moment our children are born in this particular cultural moment, that's why it seems so disturbing to so many of us. But understand, for our kids, this is the only world they know. They're told from the very beginning that their fundamental goal in life is to find themselves sexually. That it's the most important aspect of who they are. You see, the understanding of being made in the image and likeness of God hasn't been replaced with sexual categories. That's the first god of our age, is sex. Second god of our age, self. Second god of our age is self. Right? Scripture, the first commandment that God gave the Israelites was, thou shalt have no other God before what? Me. We've turned that into, I will have no other God except for me. that we've put ourselves and elevated ourselves to being God. By the way, this was actually Nietzsche's primary point in another parable that he told, Thus Spake Zarathustra. He kind of alludes to it in the parable of the madman when he says, must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of the murder of God? Right? So if you're going to kill God, somebody's got to take his place. And his parable, Thus Spake Zarathustra, this was the idea of the Ubermensch or the Superman. If God's dead, somebody's got to take his place. Now, don't get me wrong. Nietzsche didn't want God to return, right? He was just saying that the utopianists around him were completely missing the consequences of taking God out of the public imagination. He believed that what was going to happen is that there was going to be an elevation of individuals who themselves wanted to be God, who had a Superman complex or a God complex. By the way, can you think of anyone in the 20th century that had a God complex? Yeah, there's a couple names that come to mind. Can you think of anyone in the 21st century that might have had a God complex? Right? So in other words, I want you to see how this is just the natural consequences of ideas. Of course, one of the great ironies, and I'm going to come back to this later on this week, is that when you remove God and try to elevate the self, what you actually do is ultimately devalue what it means to be human and devalue the self. That's the great irony of the secular project. Henry Grunewald, in that article that I mentioned earlier, when he looks at the 20th century, he actually predicts that. He actually notes that. He said the great loss of the 20th century. He actually says, listen, the story of the 20th century was not just the story of physical violence and technological progress. It was the story of dehumanization. He's writing about that in 1992, and we've seen that. More on that later on in the week. Here's the third god of our age. Ready? State. State, right? Scripture tells us that a sparrow doesn't fall to the ground without God noticing. Tells us to remember that our God shall provide all of our needs according to his goodness and according to his mercy. But we live in a time in which we don't look to God to provide all of our needs. We look to who? The state to provide all of our needs. The state shall provide all of our needs. The state really has, in many ways, taken the place of God. And you see this. You actually see God-like language. This is one of the things that you're going to talk about during the next week. And by the way, one of the reasons I wanted to start with these kind of five gods of our age, because I think this week, as we talk about the different challenges to religious liberty, and we talk about them specifically in areas of life and marriage and family and education and all the different college campuses and all the different places the ADF goes to work. When we talk about that, you'll be able to see these gods reflected in the challenges of our day, right? One of them, for example, is the arrogance of the state, particularly over the last five or so years, to tell us what counts as legitimate religious belief and what doesn't. What counts as real Christianity and what doesn't? We've seen cases of that, for example, in the HHS mandate. The HHS mandate, that was the real problem there, in addition to prescribing, you know, nuns to have to provide contraception. I mean, that's just kind of silly, but the real issue there was the state came out and said, this is what counts as a religious group, this is what counts as religious activity, and that's, of course, the same thing that happened in the case of Jack and Baronel. This is what counts as religious activity, and this does not. The fourth S. Number one, sex. Number two, self. Number three, state. Number four, science. Science is another god of our age, right? One of the things that you see throughout the New Testament, and actually throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament, is this phrase repeated over and over, thus saith the Lord, thus saith the Lord, thus saith the Lord. Some of us grew up in churches where we used to have this phrase, God said it, I believe it, and that settles it. Anybody grow up like that, right? In other words, there was an idea that there was, basically this is pointing to God's authority. Yeah, God is the authority over the world, but the new authority is science. It stops debate, right? The number one thing that stops debate, the science is settled. The science is settled. Now, first of all, let's just acknowledge something out front, right? If the science is settled, it's not science. The definition of science is that things are constantly being tested and reworked and questioned, and constantly being tested and reworked and questioned. That's what science is. Science is never settled. If science is settled, it ceases to be science and it starts to be dogma. And so we've seen that. We've seen that in a couple of different areas. I think some of us would say we've seen that in some of the climate scientists, that one set of folks who are telling us certain things about the climate, the science is settled, and if you disagree with that, you're no longer allowed to be a scientific voice in the debate. But where we're really seeing that, of course, is in areas of gender. I think it's, I saw on the schedule, it's either today or tomorrow, we're going to have those conversations about gender. And that's really what we have seen, is the scientific debate has been squashed. Of all places. The Atlantic, just a few months ago, published an article that was stunning. It was an article in which a major center-left publication in America, it was acknowledged that there were individuals on the planet who were what we call detransitioners. They transitioned genders and they transitioned back. Not only that, but that it acknowledged that pediatricians and child psychologists were too quick these days to prescribe medication to promote gender change among minors. And they were too quick to go along with children who themselves feel like they were, had gender dysphoria, and they were too quick to encourage that transition. This was in the Atlantic. By the way, did anybody see this article? If you didn't see this article, you need to look it up. I'm blanking on the name of it. Some of you might remember. But you need to look at this article and then look at the response to the article. I mean, this wasn't Christianity Today publishing it. This wasn't some right-wing organization, like ADF publishing it, right? This was The Atlantic. And the author was called homophobic, transphobic, and all the other words. Why? Because the science is settled, is what we're told. But I think the greatest example of this when it comes to science is in the HB2 conversations in the state of North Carolina. When a child psychologist from Duke University, when that case was, when that law that Charlotte made, and then of course the state came and made a law that Charlotte couldn't make a law without the state approval, and it was all having to do with transgender restrooms, that a child psychologist from Duke University said, I don't know if you saw this, said that when it comes to gender, determining gender, chromosomes, hormones, reproductive organs, and external genitalia are not scientific ways of determining sex and gender. They're not scientific ways of determining sex and gender, right? The science is settled. Here's the last one, by the way. Quickly, I got a minute left. The last god of our age. Sex, self, state, science. By the way, you impressed with that alliteration? That's pretty good, isn't it? Here's the fifth one. Stuff. 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 Right? We love stuff. Blaise Pascal famously said that we have a God-shaped hole in our heart that only God can fill. But I tell you what, you watch too many commercials these days, and you quickly start to believe, not that we have a God-shaped hole, but that we have a Lexus-shaped hole, that only Lexus can fill. Now, why do the gods of our age matter? I'd love to spend more time talking about stuff. Just quickly, here's the way, I'll tell you what. Psalm 135. I'm going to close with this. Psalm 135. We're going to pick this up again tomorrow. In Psalm 135, David, the psalmist, is appealing to the nation of Israel not to worship idols, not to have a correct understanding of God. A.W. Tozer said, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What I've argued today, it's not just the most important thing about us as individuals, it's the most important thing about us as nations. Psalm 135, David gives you 14 verses of reasons to worship the God of Israel, because he's good, he's gracious, he's faithful, he's sovereign. But there's a punchline to this in verse 15. After giving us 14 good reasons to worship God, he then contrasts God with the idols. And he says, the idols of the nations are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak. They have eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, nor is their breath in their mouths. Now we know that. We know it's weird for someone to take a block of wood, carve an ear on it, and pray to it. But that's not the whole point. And this is where we're going to go for the rest of the week. Ready? Verse 18. Those who make them, the idols, become what? Like them. And so do all who trust in them. Follower of Jesus, watch what you worship. Because what you worship, you become. We start to see ourselves in the image of whatever it is that we worship. That is true for us as individuals, and it's true of us together, as families, as communities, as nations, and as civilizations.
Thanks for listening to the Breakpoint Podcast and John Stone Street's presentation at the Alliance Defending Freedom. Friday, be sure to join John Stone Street and Ed Stetzer on Breakpoint this week as they discuss the top issues of the week from a Christian worldview perspective.